is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And good afternoon, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And we greatly appreciate you taking time with us today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And if you're with that distinguished group that's joining us live, if you are so interested, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room where you can roll in with the usual suspects. If you have some observations you'd like to make during the course of the show, or if there's a question you wish we would direct to our guest in the course of the next hour, that's a great place to put it in. We'll do our best to fold that in as the show progresses. And if you got to jump off halfway through the show, or you just want to catch up on some previous shows you may have missed, you can always subscribe to the free podcast over at iTunes, or you can just get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio. Now, for today's show, we're going to focus feet dry, looking at a lot of the issues that are going on land. When you look at the growing conventional strength from nations who most likely do not desire the best for our nation and do want to challenge our nation's global position, to the unending requirements for counterinsurgency, are we looking smartly, looking in the right directions to make sure we have the right balance? And our guest today for the full hour is Paul Sharp. He is a senior fellow at the Center for New American Security and a former Army Ranger with service in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Paul, welcome to Midrats.
Thanks for having me.
Really appreciate it. And it's got kind of a scene setter for those that might not have had an opportunity to read your latest. And Paul has a lot of works, but if you haven't had a chance to look at the link that we've provided in the pre-show material, I'd recommend the guests to go ahead and look over at CNAS's publication from December of 2015, Uncertain Ground, Emerging Challenges, and Land Warfare, which in a way will be a touchstone for us during the course of the next hour. And Paul, building off that part of that title, Emerging Challenges, in a real broad sense, what are some of the most significant features of the emerging challenges we're seeing on the land side of the house?
Yeah, thanks, Al. You know, the focus of this report was trying to understand, as the ground forces, you know, so the Army, Marine Corps, and Special Operations Command, are coming out of this long period of large-scale counterinsurgency wars, not just, you know, sort of what are the challenges they need to focus on, because you've got a range of different things. Certainly Russia looking more relevant these days. Continued instability in the Middle East, whether it's against ISIS or other kinds of challenges. And then, of course, you know, long-term commitments we still have in Korea, and the ground forces have a role to play in the rest of the Asia-Pacific as well. We wanted to kind of look at what's new, right? What's different, or maybe what's, in many cases in warfare, you know, looks very similar to things from the past, but maybe with a different twist on it. And so just kind of highlight a couple key things that I thought were kind of interesting. One is across the board, looking at a variety of different actors from major nation-state land powers like Russia, down to, you know, hybrid actors that might be state-sponsored, like Hezbollah or non-state groups, or even, you know, lone wolf terrorists, an increasing lethality in the types of power that they're able to bring. And it comes from a range of different things. Some of it comes from just better technology, better precision, sometimes things that are commercial off the shelf. In the case of, say, a lone wolf terrorist, somebody could go and, you know, cobble together, you know, a swarm of drones to carry out, you know, an autonomous attack against soft targets, like maybe a public building. all the way to, on the high end, certainly Russia has been modernizing their ground forces and is doing some pretty sporty things in Ukraine right now in terms of electronic warfare, using drones for artillery spotting, using very lethal artillery attacks. Phil Carber has written quite a bit on this, and employing quite a bit of lethality and firepower. And in the middle of that spectrum, the proliferation of anti-tank guided missiles is really changing how we think about non-state actors and the lethality they can bring to bear. What we've seen in the last 10 or 15 years in terms of non-state groups in Iraq and Afghanistan is really nothing compared to the types of lethality that we're seeing in, say, Syria today in terms of anti-tank guided missiles that are extremely effective. And there are countermeasures that we have to those in terms of things like reactive armor, but there are, countermeasures to those, and it's a constant struggle. So this increase in lethality is very significant because it's not necessarily just an incremental step forward in, the next, modernization of various kinds of military equipment. A lot of it is driven by computers, electronics that allows greater precision and greater autonomy in various kinds of weapons, whether it's, top attack weapons like a centrifuge weapon that can, put out little skeets that can home in on tanks using infrared sensing, to homing missiles, anti-tank-guided missiles, to, say, an autonomous drone. That kind of technology, information technology, is enabling militaries or non-state groups to put a large amount of explosives very precisely on a small area. It's really hard to defend against that. The material science just isn't there, right? And so that sort of shifts the offense-defense balance at the tactical level, right? Makes it much harder to defend in that kind of environment. If you can be seen and targeted, you're very, very vulnerable, very at risk. And this is, I'd say for a naval audience, right, a lot of this is a shift that happened in naval warfare a long time ago, right? We don't rely on armor to stop missiles coming in. Instead, we've got things like SeaWiz and other types of technology. So that sort of drives in the ground domain. People will think more about active protection systems, both soft and hard kill. So that's a big piece of it. But the other, I think it's somewhat more interesting part of what we're seeing that's changing on the ground environment, and in part because it's not something that normally we might seize on in militaries, is this democratization of information that's coming from things like smartphones in the hands of everyday citizens. And we've seen here in the United States how that's dramatically changed policing, how we talk about policing, the level of transparency that goes on in terms of the interactions of police with the citizens. And I don't think that our ground forces are really ready for that shift to happen in ground combat. We've seen in the last 15 years what happens when they're kind of one-off incidents, when somebody on the ground, one of our soldiers or Marines, does something stupid. People are urinating on corpses or they're burning Korans or something, and you see big strategic effects from that. But shifting to a world where every single thing that our people do on the ground is recorded and tweeted around in real time and goes viral, that's a very different social environment. And that can have very important implications for how we operate, for operational security, protecting our forces. And I don't know that we've yet sort of incorporated that reality into our training. And in some part because it's difficult to do both, right? So now you've got the Army coming out of this basically training and preparing for counterinsurgency for a decade plus. They're saying, what do I prepare on? I got to focus on Russia. And oh, by the way, I got to focus on, how would I do, a crisis response in a place like Cairo with a digitized and connected population. And those are different challenges, but there are some environments where they overlap very well, right? In the Ukraine today, you would have a lot of both. And so those are the kind of things that we need to be prepared for.
One of the things in your article that I appreciated was your, I don't want to say ridiculing, but sort of distinguishing between what we call warfare and the new terms that that the buzzwords that float around, hybrid warfare or asymmetric warfare, and you kind of discount that there's that much difference. Can you kind of discuss that, what you're talking about there?
Yeah, so, I mean, for the, you know, entirety of the last, I guess, 20 years or so, right, we've spent a lot of energy intellectually in the U.S. military and sort of the broader military defense community trying to come up with these labels to describe conflict that doesn't play to our strengths or our comfort zone, right? We used to call these things in the 90s military operations other than war, right? And we treated them like they were lesser included. So we'll plan for what we think war is, and then we'll worry about, you know, everything else. We'll just figure it out as we go along. That didn't work out real well in Iraq and Afghanistan. We ended up with ground forces that were just not ready. We did great when we needed to knock down Saddam's army and take Baghdad, and then we kind of didn't know what to do next, right? And so now, you know, and then we had these long-winded debates about irregular warfare. It's not, it's something different, right? We talk about unconventional warfare. Now we're talking about gray zones and hybrid war, right? And I think one of my observations about these terms, and they're not totally useless in the sense that they're a little bit messy sometimes because people can be meaning very different things, right? You know, you can have a conversation with people talking about something like hybrid warfare, and everyone's got a very different vision in their head about what it means. They can be useful terms sometimes if you can be more specific. But I think my observation as a whole, looking at all of this, is that we need to expand our paradigm of what war is, right? I think actually this all comes from watching too many World War II movies. I think that's the root of the problem here. And we have this sort of this vision of this archetype of war where, you know, we declare war and they declare war and we send our armies out to fight each other and everybody's wearing a uniform and we kill each other like civilized people and then somebody surrenders and we sign a piece of paper and we're done. And it's not that that never happens, but that's the exception rather than the rule. Even in interstate conflict, that sort of getting to the point of total capitulation is the exception. A lot of times you get something that looks a lot more like Korea, right, where there's a resettling of the balance and sort of things peter out, and maybe there's a truce, and then there's a flare-up later on. So it happened after Desert Storm, right? I mean, the conflict itself was conventional in the sense that it sort of fit our mold of what war looks like, but the ending was rather unsatisfactory, and then we ended up with a very lengthy air operation all through the 90s, and then of course the Iraq War in 2003. So, you know, I think it just suggests to me as a whole we need to sort of reset our thinking about what war is, and not be labeling. The thing that really bothers me, and I'll acknowledge a bias here, right, is that I think a lot of this labeling can then mean the thing that we're labeling is something less than war, right? A gray zone conflict is less than war, potentially, because it doesn't get to the real decisive phase three operations, which is what kind of we want to get to, right? It's all this messy stuff earlier, right? Irregular warfare is less than war because it's against kind of non-state actors. And I think why that's dangerous is because it can diminish our focus on these other different types of conflicts, or different ways of fighting, that our adversaries are paying attention to, that they're exploiting, whether they're terrorist groups or nation states like Russia and China and Iran. And it means that we're less prepared, we're less ready. And when those things happen, we pay a price, right? And my personal bias here was fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we really weren't ready, right? And I don't think that the ground forces, the Army and Marine Corps, have necessarily done a very honest look back and accounting of saying, hey, look, we kind of screwed this up, right, the first couple of years, and we weren't prepared as a force. How do we make sure that we're prepared for the right things in the future? And it's, you know, it's kind of this labeling is kind of biting us in the ass today in against Russia and China, right, in the Ukraine and Crimea, in the South China Sea, where they're exploiting these sort of seams in these uncomfortable spaces that are short of what we like to think of as war, but are very real. They involve the use of militaries and military force and military power, and they're used to accomplish political aims. And so, I think that the thinking about how we think about war is certainly important, The other component of this that I think really matters for the ground forces is this sort of human dimension of conflict, right? This idea that war is ultimately, this is a social activity, and identity matters. How we talk about war matters. The narrative matters a lot. And sometimes we just sort of look at the hardware, right? Tell me where I need to put my bombs. What do I blow up, right? How many ships do I sink? How many, you know, airfields do I crater? Now, that's obviously an important part of war. That's what makes it war and, you know, and not a polite conversation. But the social aspect of war matters a lot. And when you sort of look at this, the changing social landscape that comes about from increasing connectivity and increasing democratization of information among ordinary citizens, right, then it means that for the ground forces, they really need to pay attention to that even more, because they can do the right, they can get in a situation where they're doing the right things in terms of, you know, hardware, but if they lose the narrative and they lose support of the people, they can be in a really tough spot.
Mike Eagle One, that's one thing I really enjoyed about your article is kind of, it's not so much putting people on report, but saying that the buzzword situation, I find them, whether we're talking about the gray zones or the hybrid warfare, because it prevents you from looking at very real things and speaking clearly about things, because in many ways, this isn't the first time we've been confronted with such challenges. They were just called different things. And another thing that along that line I wanted to touch with you on is, and it ties into a desire not so much to create new buzzwords to get attention, but almost an intellectual desire to avoid some hard truths and some hard realities, usually based upon experience, some of it very recent, like you outlined with our need to honestly address what we've seen. And that has to do with a lot of the terms we've seen thrown around recently, information dominance, which is part of information warfare, but in a different way than traditionally thought, and how people want to talk about cyber. And in many ways, their strongest advocates, I think, have lost the bubble, the fact they are supporting organizations, not supported. Do you see any danger of people looking for that magic key or that magic solution in the fuzzy and non-bloody supporting concept of information warfare in cyber? Or are we self-correcting towards maybe incorporating a little more balance in how they mix with everything else that we need to do?
Yeah, no, I think it's right that we need balance. I think there's a natural tension in sort of the dialogue about how warfare is evolving and changing between voices, and sometimes you get the same people, you know, the same person might say both things, right? But between looking at things that are new and saying, okay, what's new here? What's changing and evolving? Because warfare is always, you know, the tactics and operations that people are using are always changing and evolving. We've seen incredible changes in warfare in the last 100 or 150 years. War expanding, up in the early 20th century into three dimensions, up in the air, under sea, now in space, in the electromagnetic spectrum, in cyberspace, whatever that is, right? If you want to think of cyberspace as a domain, some people don't like that. But so I think it's important to always be on the lookout. On the other hand, there's an element of there's nothing new under the sun that's very, very true, right? Sun Tzu talks about deception and information operations and information warfare. And, you know, we have sort of had this collective experience in the U.S. military of relearning lessons of counterinsurgency. Insurgency is, of course, very old, right? Terrorism is very old. And one of the interesting things about going through this, the study that we did looking at sort of the challenges that the ground forces are facing was one of the, you know, quote-unquote new challenges, if you will, that we're faced, that we're looking at is, okay, Russia, right? Well, that's very old, right? That's something we were focused on quite a bit 20, 25 years ago and earlier. But there's elements of it that are different, that have changed, that Russia's modernized their forces, they're now incorporating electronic warfare and cyber attacks and propaganda. Russia's got, Twitter bots that they use to spread propaganda on Twitter. And so this element of trying to understand what do those things mean, right? How do I fight using in this information space, in this this sort of social domain that's comprised of social media and other things? It's very different from, say, 100 years ago where you could bomb the radio tower, right? And then you eliminate, right, effectively the ability for, information and propaganda on behalf of the enemy. This is extremely different. On the other hand, information is not lethality, right? Information is an enabler. It's important. At the end of the day, information is not protection, right? It's not mobility. All of those things matter. In war, you need to have protection. You need to have lethality. You need to have mobility. You got to have communication between the forces. You want to have some information about the battlefield. I think one of the interesting lessons about the role of information in conflict, because we've been in this world where in the last 15, 20 years, our access to information has just exploded, right? It's such a very different world from the battlefield that sort of in the Napoleonic era, where there's very little information at all, right? And trying to sort of discern through the smoke and the haze and the sounds what's going on out there and make decisions. Now, with this flood of information, but we don't know what's real, what's valid, what's out of date. Things are very confusing. It's confusing among even your own forces. Where are people are? What are they doing right now? And so I think in the 90s, when people started to sort of grasp that we're in the middle of this information revolution, there was this idea that we would have, total information awareness, or we would understand the environment, or we would have information dominance. And that has been, I think, all for the better, really, really blasted apart by, at least for the ground forces, the experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan, that the fog of war, the sort of ugly mess of realities of friction and confusion is something that people really understand on a visceral level. And I don't see that in larger scale conflicts as well. So, and one of the interesting sort of paradigms that came out of that in the special operations community was this concept of, instead of waiting in the early couple of years, I remember this as a Ranger, we would do some sort of sitting back and waiting for more information to get more information to then go out and conduct raids and to do strike operations. We'd say, we're mapping the enemy network. We have some information about people, but we don't really know enough, so we're going to wait. And over time, the special operations community discarded that model, and they adopted a mantra of strike to develop. Basically, you get information by going out into the battlefield and doing something, and taking some kind of action, and then that drives the enemy to change, or maybe you learn, okay, they weren't here, or in the case of raids for special operators, you capture someone, you get some information, you get some documents, and so it's a very different kind of way of thinking. Basically, to say, look, we have to raise commanders that accept that uncertainty and confusion and are not going to sit back and wait for more. They're going to take action and sort of provoke the battle space and then learn and find and get some kind of information and then keep learning, right? So it's not actually the OODA loop, the observe, orient, decide, act loop, right? It's act, learn, and then decide and act again.
Yeah, as I was going through the article, and thinking of OODA, things have changed quite a bit because, as you said, at one point, the World War II model, we're really dealing with major powers against major powers, nation states against nation states. Now, I think, as you pointed out, article, everybody's got a SAM. Everybody's got an anti-tank guided missile. Everybody's got an IED. Everybody's got a drone. Everybody's got a 3D printer. Everybody is now a reporter using their cell phones and stuff. And the question is, how do we fight? How do we prepare our troops to wrestle with those issues, and is the answer fewer smarter troops, where do you see an answer headed as those things unfold?
That's a great question. I think a lot of it has to do with for some of these things in the ground environment, our best solution is going to be in the training environment, right? So there isn't going to necessarily be an easy technology that's going to allow us to – there's something on the horizon at least, right, that allow us to walk into an unknown place and map out all of the the social media interactions that are ongoing and track all that and understand it and digest that quickly and give it to our folks. That'd be great. Maybe people are working on that. I saw a presentation from an IT coordinator at the Boston Police Department last year where he was talking about they are still sifting through Twitter feeds. I mentioned this in the report. Following the Boston Marathon bombing attacks, in the first few minutes after the attacks, there was such a flood of activity on Twitter. They're now trying to go back, and there are people going through manually to try to see if there was information that they could have used at the time to help find the bomber sooner, if there were clues there. They just didn't have the tools to sift through. And so, to do that realistically in real time, you need automated tools that can sift through that. Not quite there yet. But then to translate that to a different language, a different social context, and probably different digital infrastructure in some new place, and be able to do that anywhere you want to go on a moment's notice in a crisis, that's a pretty tall order. So I think a lot of it's going to come down to training, just like I suspect that the training environment and the environment that sort of police officers here in the United States are dealing with this has shifted in terms of, being aware that you could be everything you're doing could be recorded and up on the evening news and sent around on Twitter in no time. So I think that at least in that case, that's going to be a very different kind of thing. It's interesting. There was maybe 15 years ago, there were various proposals put forward by a number of smart folks talking about sort of bifurcating the ground forces, having a very kinetic force to go in and smash militaries like Russia's or Saddam's army, and then something that looks more like a peacekeeping force that can go in and interact with the population. And it sounds appealing in an abstract sense, in the sense that those are different types of skills, and they're both really, really difficult. And you just don't have enough time to kind of train on everything you'd like to train on. The difficulty that I saw firsthand in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I actually think is getting harder over time, is that in the reality on the ground, both of those problem sets are intertwined in many cases. You're having more lethal firepower in the hands of even non-state actors, as well as more information technology and sort of social context that's in the hands of them, as well as nation states like Russia, who are able to exploit a lot of propaganda and information operations.
I liked how earlier you mentioned that some of our problems can be derived from a little bit too many World War II movies. And this is also the 25th anniversary, and you mentioned it earlier on in the show as well, of Desert Storm, where I cut my teeth as an 01 and an 02. And that was kind of the top of the arc of the Cold War combined arm construct. What we've seen since then is throughout the world, an acceleration of urbanization. And I think a great demonstration of that visually recently, especially on Twitter, which is a great place to find their updates, ISW, the Institute for Study of War, they have kind of created the industry standard, I think, of what the Islamic State is controlling. And it's not your standard view of control of territory where you have this lat long, draw a straight line to that lat long. They're focused on urban centers, population concentrations, and ground lines of communication. And they don't give credit for these big open spaces. So you have these Rorschach test areas of control. And coming out of our experience, especially in Iraq, where those great M1 tanks that did the great left hook in Desert Storm are now going down alleyways where you have half a meter either side of the tank, have we really inculcated how the accelerated urbanization of the world should affect how our ground forces and our concept of combined arms and large-scale warfare needs to be addressed, adjusted, trained, and equipped.
Well, I think that the folks I talk to in the Army and Marine Corps very much are seized of the problem in the sense of they certainly understand that urban warfare has always been messy and difficult and violent, and that you know, you've got sort of multiple overlapping problems of there are more people than ever on the globe, population's increasing. You have on top of that urbanization. People are living, you know, more people are living in urban areas, and the rise of very, very large urban areas, like mega cities that have just massive, massive populations. The Army did a major report on mega cities last year. That was a big focus of efforts. Now, that a focus solely on large-scale mega cities can lead to all sorts of discussions about why would we be going into, you know, a city that has a population the size of, you know, a country, right? And what are we going to do in a city the size of, you know, 10 million or something? Valid point. You know, occupying a city, you know, Mexico City is not practical, right? Even if you wanted to do something, it's just not doable. But there might be reasons why you need to go in terms of a humanitarian operation that then goes awry, trying to go nab a terrorist, something like Black Hawk Down on a much, much larger scale, or evacuating an embassy. Those, I mean, there are reasonable situations that one can conjure where you put military forces into this kind of very difficult environment. And, of course, you don't need a megacity to get a difficult urban environment. But it's very challenging in the sense of reduced lines of sight, three-dimensional threats, and it's difficult. There are, I think, some opportunities with things like robotics and drones to use them as scouts to sort of build yourself a little bit of a bubble, buying yourself some information, some time to ID and identify threats. I remember just walking through the streets of Bakuba in Iraq. It's the capital of Diyala province, just northeast of Baghdad. And we had bad problems with suicide bombers in the city. And we had lost an entire squad one day, I mean, effectively, killed or wounded, when a suicide bomber came around a corner in an alleyway and was just right on top of them. And they didn't have any distance, any kind of, you know, buffer or lines of sight or anything to see this person approaching and address them early on and try to get them to stop or kind of say, or right in the middle of the squad and blew up this fast. And so that sort of urban environment is very difficult. It's something that we've dealt with to some extent in Iraq, but you could be looking at things that are much larger scale in terms of cities or much higher intensity of violence, you know, in the sense of a really nasty fight in an urban area on a scale that we didn't really see in the original assault on Baghdad in 2003. There was a fight, but certainly not as bad as we could have had or you could have in future wars. But there isn't any easy silver bullet for how to deal with that problem, to be honest.
When as we work into these modern situations, how important is it for our military to have a better human terrain analysis group to deal with some of the issues of I hate to use the expression from my times in Vietnam, but hearts and minds, help us understand what the locals of the areas we occupy want.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big themes of the report is trying to sort of emphasize that the human domain or human terrain or however you want to sort of characterize it as conflict is not only something that matters in counterinsurgencies. I do think there's a bit of a risk, particularly in the Army, if the Army begins to sort of focus on Russia, as they should, as a major challenge. I would say not the only one, but as a major challenge. There's a risk that we sort of sweep away some of the lessons of paying attention to the human and social element of conflict as, well, that's for those counterinsurgency wars. We're not going to worry about that. We just got to worry about blowing things up. Because I think the ground domain is almost unique in the sense that really the people are infused into the domain itself, right? Up in the air or at sea in the high seas, right? Like, we might care about things like information operations and propaganda. We might care, particularly, you know, in an escalation phase of a conflict, if the adversary is trying to do something to maybe provoke us or maybe make us look bad. In the ground, you're fighting among the people, right? It's hard to envision, you know, the Desert Storm was a little bit unique in that respect, in that, you know, we managed to fight in kind of big open desert. It's hard to imagine the adversary being dumb enough to do that again. And so you're in a situation, and just there's reality, there's just more people on the planet and there's more urban areas. So you're fighting amongst this environment where whether the people support your aims, how they react to you, is going to change the environment. It's going to make it more or less hostile. And that's something we need to be very cognizant of. And it's not something that you can sort of relegate to the end of the conflict, right? So you go, well, we're going to go in and break everything, and then we'll send in those civil affairs people, and they'll do the, whatever they got to do afterwards, right, and worry about it. And so I think there's – I'm not saying that necessarily we're there right now, but I think there's a bit of a risk of getting to that kind of place. And so one of the themes of the report is to say, look, all of these lessons that we've learned about paying attention to what the people think and the social elements of conflict, we need to hold on to that. We need to hold on to those tools, whether they're in information operations or civil affairs or other things. We need to be able to engage the population to the best extent we can, right? Sometimes they're going to be hostile to you, but even then we need to pay attention to, you know, how do they respond to our activities? Is there a way to diffuse our hostility? Is there a way to convince them that they've been defeated, right? How do we do that in a way so we're not then fighting sort of a long insurgency, certainly like we saw in Iraq, where you had hangers-on. Well, they're still fighting, frankly. You've got elements of the Ba'athist regime that are still fighting.
We've enjoyed a comparative advantage the last couple of decades in technology for communications, and especially for reconnaissance, overhead reconnaissance, and it's with the growth of unmanned systems, drones, however you want to refer to them. And in your article, and other people have written about it as well, that technology has gone in the direction technology always has, not just in making things smaller, but making them easier to build and to make them more flexible, more efficient, more available. And when there was a previous technology cycle decades ago where we had a comparative advantage in radar and missiles, when opponents were able to also reach that level and we no longer own that particular sphere, electronic warfare on the offensive really had a heyday, and what I like to call the deny and fry. You deny them by jamming, or you fry them, anti-radiation missile, or the up-close and personal wild weasels of the Vietnam era. With the urbanization combined with the access of handheld computers in visual surveillance, known as smartphones, drones that are very easy to produce, commercial off-the-shelf, they can give real-time video for just a few $100s. Are we as a ground force looking at having to look back to what was done before and get to the point when it comes to going into areas that are saturated with the opponent using commercial communications, visual, and surveillance technology, and having the ability, if block by block, of being able to deny people's access to those networks and to fry the equipment that they're using against us in that type of environment? Do we need to reach that point to start thinking about fielding that capability to our forces?
Yeah, I think we're not there in terms of having the right equipment now. I do hear from people in the Army looking at this that people are seized of that challenge. They're incorporating more cyber and electronic warfare threats into their training exercises. There's actually a very interesting piece by Patrick Tucker in Defense One this week about the, some sort of GPS-guided parachutes that we've been using, say, in Afghanistan to resupply remote outposts, that people working on using visual-aided navigation so they can operate in GPS-denied environments. And so I think people are seized of this challenge of how to operate in this very contested electromagnetic environment where you're frying the enemy, deceiving the enemy about where you are, hiding your forces, communicating in spite of jamming, and then doing ISR and PNT, position, navigation, and timing, in spite of a GPS jamming environment. One of the interesting challenges in vis-a-vis Russia is that if we had to fight a ground war in Europe now, say defending a NATO ally like the Baltic states, the border is now so close to Russian territory that it has all of the elements of the anti-access problems that people have been describing vis-a-vis China in sort of an air and maritime environment in terms of long-range missile threats and particularly very challenging anti-air threats. SAMs from Russia. The difference is we would have to fight ground on the ground inside that A280 bubble, right under that umbrella, where we don't have the ability to do sort of the slow peel the onion approach and kind of take our time to degrade the adversary's A280 network as we can come in. We have to have ground troops in very quickly to defend NATO allies' territory, right before Russia would sort of take territory and create a fait accompli. So how do you do that when you're still fighting in this contested electromagnetic and cyber environment under within range of long-range artillery and, more importantly, for the ground forces without U.S. air superiority, right? That's a huge paradigm shift. We have taken for granted on the ground that if you hear a jet overhead, that's an American jet. And that's not... that's not going to be the case necessarily in a conflict in Europe against Russia. It also, interestingly, is a problem on the other side of the spectrum against non-state groups. Because now what you might hear overhead is the buzz of a little drone. And that could be anybody's, right? That could be just some local person's got a drone, right? And they put some explosives on it, or they got a camera on it, and they're streaming your position online somewhere for anyone else to use. So that's a different kind of threat environment too, where you could on the high end have a ground conflict without U.S. air superiority or contested airspace at least, and on the low end you could have one where, yeah, at 30,000 feet the U.S. Air Force owns the skies, but at 300 feet it's anybody's game. So that's a really important dimension to sort of changing the threat picture for people on the ground.
Yeah, I was amused earlier by your reference to World War II movies and how that may have focused our thinking in ways that have kind of made us more rigid than we should have been. But I also know that for a couple of generations now, people have looked at movies like Red Dawn and the heroic resistance fighters hiding up in the mountains, fighting back against invaders. Are there lessons that we should have learned from other social media? I mean, I count the movie as a social media, but that we could have used a movie like that to help our troops understand what the resistance fighters are in these various countries we look at are looking at.
Yeah, that's a good point, because Red Dawn is a great. This may not be the case anymore with like sort of the generation of millennials that's probably, you know, junior enlisted folks and officers now, but at least for my generation, a great touchstone in that you could have gone to anybody else in my unit and everybody had seen Red Dawn probably like a gazillion times. The interesting thing to me thinking about that kind of problem in places like in Iraq and Afghanistan was sometimes insurgency or counterinsurgency is described as the graduate level of war. Counterinsurgency is so much harder than other types of war. And I guess I'll just say from my end, I never felt that way. That never made any sense. Essence of it seems so intuitive if you take a step back and think about it from the other person's perspective, which Red Dawn does, right? If a bunch of foreigners came into America, you know, how would we treat them? Well, everybody, you know, run into their basement and grab their you know, AR-15, and people would fight back, right? And so, how, you know, if you think about it from that standpoint, and I remember being very cognizant of this, walking around places in Afghanistan as a ranger, going to places where no American had been to before, and, you know, that, hey, look, we're setting an example to this village of what, you know, who America is and what we're doing. And we, you know, can either make this, I wouldn't say necessarily friendly, right, but maybe a cautiously neutral place or a hostile place, and we can do that, you know, pretty quickly. And so we kind of think about it that way, and you say, well, look, you know, how would good old boys in West Virginia treat foreigners if they came into the United States? You go, okay, well, maybe we shouldn't be a jerk to people, right? One of the things that, like, I was a non-commissioned officer. I was a sergeant. So, I was on the ground with the troops. I don't mean this in a demeaning way, but I wasn't back in the talk somewhere, you know, making PowerPoint slides. One of the things that concerns me very much about this sort of, but one of the things that concerns me very much about sort of this proliferation of smartphone technology is I saw a lot of things on the ground that I'll tell you right now, the colonel doesn't see, right? Because Joe's not stupid, and he's not going to do this stuff in front of an officer or you know, maybe the lieutenant sees it, but certainly the colonel doesn't. And where I would, you know, I remember going on operations where you'd see somebody do something just dumb. It's not a war crime, but they're just being a jerk to somebody for no good reason. And they're being hostile, and they're, you know, accusing people of being insurgents when they're just minding their own damn business, sitting in their house. And you leave going, well, wow, if those people weren't opposed to us beforehand, they really are now. And so that's about better training. It's frankly, some of it's about better selection and screening of people and weeding out bad apples. And we've seen, you know, some of the prices that we pay when you know, some bad apple does something horrific. But even when you rule out people that are doing things that are war crimes, you just, the day-to-day interactions that our soldiers and Marines have on the ground with the population matters so much. It's so critical towards winning over people. And again, I can't stress enough, one of the themes in this report is that, yeah, that matters in counterinsurgency, and we kind of get that it matters. I don't know that we've done a great job of it, but we understand that it matters. But it's going to matter in other conflicts as well. You know, if we actually had people in the Ukraine fighting, I mean, I'm suggesting we ought to, right? But if we were fighting in Europe, let's say in the Baltic states, in a Russian invasion, how our soldiers treat the civilian population there on the ground, right? You would be in the case of the Baltic states, our NATO allies, how they interact with them really matters, how they conduct themselves. Here's a movie reference, in Fury, which is all about, right, tank warfare and blowing stuff up. There's a scene, maybe three quarters of the way through the movie, where the soldiers go and they're having dinner in, I can't remember, maybe they're in the Netherlands, maybe it's a Dutch woman's house, or maybe they're in Germany. I'm not sure at this point. I don't remember. But they're in this person's house and they're having dinner, and Brad Pitt's character is sort of trying to be like a civilized, decent human being. And one of the other soldiers comes in and is basically just kind of a jerk. And makes kind of a big scene of things. And just those, you know, sort of those, how you conduct yourself really matters a lot. And it's an important thing in terms of, again, selection, recruitment, training, and, of course, leadership above all else.
Ideas and concept development is one thing, but ultimately you need a system and a bureaucratic culture that'll take the right solution, or what we think is the right solution, and put it into play. And what if you could take a couple, I'm gonna stitch together two things that aren't directly related in your work over CNAS for December that I want you to talk to the listeners a bit about. Talk for a bit about your concept of strategic agility And then a real-world example we have of our bureaucratic agility when it came to the procurement and deployment of the MRAP.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is a kind of a sad one. And I think this is an example of where I do think it really behooves us within the services and in the department as a whole to have some honest accounting, because MRAPs are kind of the thing that are held up sometimes as a success story. Now, look, the MRAP itself is a success in the sense that it, you know, was the right tool, the right response to the IAV problem, and able to save a lot of lives. But from a bureaucratic standpoint, it was a disaster. It took longer than it needed to get MRAPs out the door for no good reason. And it really wasn't actually acquisitions. It was the requirements side of the house, which if anyone, uniform or not, who's ever worked with requirements in the Pentagon, knows just what a mess the whole system is. And in the case of MRAPs, there was a significant delay in terms of getting them out to the field because of requirements being a hang-up. And there was an interesting study done by Chris Lamb and a couple other folks afterwards. So they went and they said, okay, look, we can measure IED's deaths before and after MRAPs are fielded. And there's a massive drop. And we can pick apart what comes from sort of the frequency of the IEDs, which we had a surge, we changed sort of conditions on the ground, to just like the lethality of the actual attack. And they said, all right, what if we'd have done it when we should have, when the first request came in from the field, and if instead of goofing around for 2 years, the Pentagon had started to do their job, in my view, and I worked there for a while, you know, it's supplying the people in the field with what they need. And I'll say personally, I didn't see that enough in the Pentagon. I saw a lot of focus on, we got to build, you know, it's about spending money in the future and build a force of the future based on, you know, what we imagine those threats to be. But the Pentagon's certainly not responsive enough to near-term immediate needs that we're getting either from the wars or from the combatant commanders in other areas. And they basically argued that we could have saved another 1,600 American lives if just the bureaucracy had gotten out of the way. And I just, you know, like I said, I just find that tragic, just absolutely tragic to think that you know, you've had this situation where we've lost thousands of young men and women serving their country, and those things happen. It's war. But here you've had situations where people died for no damn reason other than the bureaucracy was slow, right? And I think it's important to keep that those kind of things in mind and to be honest about it, because it's easy sitting in the Puzzle Palace, and up until coming to CNAS 2 years ago, I worked there for 5 years before that. It's easy to kind of sit in those meetings and sort of slow roll things and think, well, you know, we'll do a study and we'll do this next year and blah 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 blah, and try to find a consensus so that everybody gets along. But people pay the price, right? People pay the price in wars if they're going on in real time. But it's also a challenge in the future that, you know, if we get these things wrong, you know, one of the interesting, you brought up Desert Storm, one of the interesting things is, you know, I think, do we discount state enemies today because we had such a lopsided victory in Desert Storm, right? And I think that's a risk worth thinking about, right? I mean, there's also, another danger of sort of making everybody else to be 10 feet tall. One of the things that I hear a lot out of the Pentagon is people talk about accepting risk. You know, and people look at a scenario or a challenge and they say, well, we're going to have, we're going to have fewer forces and they're not as modernized as much as we want, so we're just going to accept risk. It means it's going to take longer and maybe we'll take more casualties, but we'll win. And maybe that's the case in some scenarios, but we don't really know at the end of the day. And there's a point where accepting risk more and more and more actually becomes failure. Right, there's a point where it becomes failure, and you don't know what that is until it happens. And so I think that the challenge looking forward in the future, whether it's looking at threats to, say, an aircraft carrier or ground conflict or air superiority, is just the urgency of making sure that we get these things right, because you only get sometimes one shot at it, right? So, new concepts are really vital, and we need the tools to really test those things out. and then to drive decisions. I'm anxious to see when the budget comes out. We've heard a lot of talk out of the Pentagon about this offset strategy. I'm anxious to see what the budget does, because that's when really the rubber hits the road. And are we going to see some investments that actually are going to change how our military is shaped in the future or not? And that's what we're going to have to see at the end of the day, is, you know, kind of the money following up that talk.
As we get more and more technically competent with things like miniaturized drones and stuff, should we be listening to the sergeants and the corporals in the field who say, "I want something I can, several. I want little tiny drones I can carry a dozen of, and let me send them up, and so I can see what's around a corner or over this wall." Is that the kind of technology that would help us be more, have less collateral damage, take care of our troops better? Is that a kind of agility that we need to have for our troops?
Yeah, I mean, I think on a tactical level, certainly those types of technologies are very useful, very impressive. We have thousands. I mean, when we talk about drones, we tend to talk about Air Force drones, of Predators and Reapers, which are very valuable. But the Army has thousands of small hand-launched drones, like Ravens and Wasps, just to kind of peer around corners and look over hillsides. And one of the things the report talks about is the incorporation of precision-guided munitions down at the squad level. And there's a variety of things that are that kind of look like early stages of this technology. Things like the AeroVironment Switchblade, which is a tube-launched UAV, about 5.5 pounds, that has a warhead, an anti-personnel warhead incorporated into the front of it. And so it flies around, and then when you find a bad guy, you just take him out. The drone, boom, you point it at him and push go, and the drone takes him out. There's the commercially available smart rifle technology from Tracking Point. DARPA's got a program, the Tracking Point rifle, if people aren't familiar with it, basically has a computer embedded in the scope that's able to account for barometric pressure and elevation and distance. I'm not sure if it does wind or not, to basically calculate all on its own sort of where to aim the rifle. So the person just sort of puts the reticle on, it's a hunting rifle, so a deer in that case, and locks on, and then the rifle does all the calculations about sort of how to all the things that a sniper would normally do or a skilled marksman, and then person pulls the trigger, gun doesn't fire, the gun waits until it's lined up perfectly because people move, and then the gun fires at the right time. So you got that. You've got DARPA has a program called Exacto, looking at a laser guided 50 caliber round they built that actually can track onto moving targets and adjust mid flight. And Raytheon just rolled out with a small grenade-launched missile, basically. It's basically a handheld missile that would fit in an undercarry tube grenade launcher that would fit underneath an M4. And it's got a range of well over a mile, laser-guided missiles. Pretty impressive. So those types of things are starting to really change precision at the ground level, bringing a lot of the things that have changed air and naval warfare now down to sort of the infantry level, which I suspect, as I mentioned in the report, will begin to change infantry combat in ways that we haven't seen since the invention of the machine gun. Here's an interesting World War II movie thing, right? The interesting thing about World War II movies is you watch them, and if you want to watch, say, Saving Private Ryan, and then we'll watch Restrepo, which is just a fabulous movie by Sebastian Younger about him and Tim Hetherington embedded with a team of soldiers on a combat outpost in Afghanistan for a year. And the combat at the infantry level is not that much different. You could take a soldier who fought in World War II and show him how to operate an M4 and give him night vision goggles. And, okay, you can see it at night now. And they'd fit. All the tactics are actually very similar. The biggest difference is you're carrying around a whole pile of batteries now. So you have to explain to the fellow how you got to change batteries out of everything you got. But everything else is pretty similar. But these types of technologies really start to change that. So how do you stay abreast of those changes And I do think that dialogue that you mentioned between the warfighters and the engineers is really vital, right? So the warfighters can say, I want this, and they don't necessarily know it's technically doable, right? And they talk to the engineers, they say, well, I can't do that, I could do this for you. And the engineers know what they can do, but they don't necessarily know what's useful, right? Or the people on the ground say, well, that's great, but can you make it lighter? Because I already got a rucksack full of stuff, right? And that dialogue is really valuable, combined with experimentation, to figure out what to do with these things, right? So I'm not a robot now. What do I do with it? How does this change my tactics? And so that one of the things the Army likes to talk about is the inner warfare between World War One and World War Two, and the Louisiana maneuvers they did, sort of uncovering new tactics for armored warfare. And that's the kind of thing we need to see today, is a new Louisiana maneuvers to begin to get at some of these issues, whether it's on the high end against a country like Russia, or down sort of changing infantry level squad tactics with some of these technologies and drones and other weapons, experimenting with it and trying these things and being willing to take risks and fail. You know, one of the things I'd like to see the Defense Department leadership do, or the next secretary, is cast the services. You know, I want to see a program from experimentation, not training, not unit validation, but experimentation. And I want you to come back in here and tell me the experiments that you did that failed and what you learned. Because if we're not willing to go do things that fail, then we're not really willing to learn. And that's really vital to staying on top of this.
Well, Paul, that has been a really informative and fast hour. I really appreciate you coming on this afternoon to join us. Before we head off, for the listeners, if they wanted to keep an eye open for you on what you have coming up next, what are you working on, and where should people keep an eye to be able to read it?
Sure. So you can take a look at our stuff at cnas.org. Our research program looking at new technologies there is called 20YY. But there's lots of other great stuff at the Center for New American Security, on Asia, the Middle East, and other things. So feel free to check it all out. I'll say the next thing that we're looking at right now is digging more into this human-machine teaming that a number of folks have been talking about in December at our conference here in Washington, D.C., as he was rolling out elements of the offset strategy. And he talked about this again in the Reagan Defense Forum earlier in the fall. He's talked quite a bit about human-machine teaming, and so we're going to be doing some work there, kind of fleshing out what does that look like, what are some examples where human-machine teaming can really make a difference, and then what, are, of course, the limitations, and how do we think about the balance between humans and machines in different ways. So look for that to come.
Excellent. Well, we wish you the best, and we look back toward the next opportunity to have you come visit Midrap.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for being here, Paul. Take care.
Thanks. Take care.
And thank you, everybody, for listening to us today. We look forward to having you visit us again for the next episode of Midwrap. Until then, have a great Navy day. And in deference to our guests, here's a hoo-ah for you. Cheers.
Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.